Let's take a listen again after 40 years. The leader of Libya, Muammar Gaddafi.
This is Muammar Gaddafi, brother leader, king of kings, and guide of the revolution of the great socialist people's Libyan Arab Jamahiriya. He's a man of many titles. Right now, he's speaking at the United Nations General Assembly. Normally, you're given about 15 minutes to speak, but Gaddafi's been speaking for more than an hour and a half. During this time, he's covered everything from the financial crisis to conspiracy theories on the assassination of JFK. All of a sudden, his translator that he's brought with him from Libya is replaced.
For the Jews, for the
this solution, the two-state solution, is not...
Behind the scenes, the original translator has had enough of having to translate Gaddafi's extremely long rant. So he quits. It's all happening live on air.
Of partition.
At this point, Gaddafi's been the leader of Libya for nearly 40 years. He came to power during the Vietnam War. And now, during the age of YouTube and Facebook, he seems ancient, a relic. He's the last of his generation of Arab dictators, Hafez al-Assad of Syria, Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt, and Saddam Hussein in Iraq. All are gone. Gaddafi, however, has endured. But now more than ever, he's the image of a man out of his time. He has a penchant for designer sunglasses, expensive snakeskin boots, and Botox. He's also just finished designing his very own supercar. And when he travels, he lives in a huge Bedouin tent where he sleeps, eats, and receives his guests. During his visit to the United Nations General Assembly, he tried to pitch it in the middle of Central Park. Publicly, Gaddafi denies that he holds any official position at all. He's a brotherly leader, a guide of Libya, governed by and for the people. It's a lie, of course.
Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, just 32 years old, the ruler of oil-rich Libya. Gaddafi came to power just 4 years ago when he deposed the aging King Idris.
Oil has made Libya rich. In his first decade in power, Gaddafi spends nearly 25% of the national budget on weapons. He buys around 4,000 tanks, 350 fighter jets, 6 submarines, and 2 frigates from the Soviets. From the French, he orders an additional 150 fighter jets, and from the Italians, he buys transport planes, helicopters, naval ships, and missiles. And so, Libya, a country that at the time had less than 3 million people, ends up with an air force as big as the French. During his military spending spree, Gaddafi declares the beginning of a new age for Libya. He names it the Cultural Revolution and declares Libya a Jamahiriya, a state of the masses. It's not capitalist or communist, but something else entirely. Power, he claims, now lies with the people. He later outlines the details in his manifesto, the Green Book, named after the colour, which, in Islam, represents prosperity, life, and paradise. He also makes sure the flag matches his new state. The first order of his cultural revolution is to make sure that no one can, or will, oppose the new regime. Intellectuals, political rivals, dissidents, and anyone critical of his ideas are simply too risky to keep around. So, in the early 70s, Gaddafi orders a purge on anyone that the regime deems an enemy of the state. Mass arrests of activists, journalists, and even students take place all around the country. Summary trials are held by new, so-called revolutionary committees, followed by public executions that are broadcast live on TV. He even hires secret police agents from communist East Germany to train and work with the Mukhabarat, Gaddafi's new internal intelligence agency, who are tasked with tracking down anyone who might speak against the colonel at home or abroad. In a few short years, he's turned Libya into an extreme surveillance state, so pervasive that neighbours inform on neighbours. Friends turn in friends. To hold his now growing number of prisoners, Gaddafi constructs dozens of prisons across Libya. Among these, Abu Salim prison is the most notorious. Everyone in Libya knows that if you're sent to Abu Salim, you don't return. Visiting families are, more often than not, denied entry, and most don't even know if their relatives are even alive. It quickly becomes known as the slaughterhouse. Publicly, Gaddafi issues several declarations that advocate human rights, personal freedoms, and criticize the West for their weapons of mass destruction while calling for a nuclear-free Middle East. But by the end of the 80s, Gaddafi has been actively collecting the building blocks for his own nuclear program for almost two decades. Just a few years later, Libya has its very own chemical weapons facility near the capital, Tripoli. Reported to cover an area of approximately 10 square kilometers, it is one of the largest in the world. According to several defectors from the Libyan army, at least one of Gaddafi's generals is quick to make use of the new facility by launching poison gas attacks against Libya's southern neighbor, Chad. Abroad, Gaddafi supports any group that challenges what he sees as colonialist or imperialist powers. To him, there's no difference between the IRA, the ANC, or the Japanese Red Army. He even personally sponsors a British Union leader during a strike, simply because he sees him as a challenge to Margaret Thatcher, who he hates. But that's not all. The Libyan government openly admits responsibility for deadly attacks on two international flights in Scotland and Nashir, as well as a nightclub in Germany. Perhaps more than anyone, Gaddafi lives by the notion of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And, bizarrely, that same logic eventually draws him close to his old nemesis, the US and Britain. By the end of the 90s, Gaddafi's been stacking up sanctions that have cost Libya a staggering $18 billion due to his campaigns of violence both at home and abroad. At the same time, as their war on terror gets underway at the start of the new millennium, the British and American intelligence services find themselves suddenly cooperating with Gaddafi. He can give them valuable intelligence and also provide a way in to the Middle East. And he does. In return, Libya's sanctions are lifted almost from one day to another. They even help deliver Gaddafi's opponents into Libyan jails. The relationship of Gaddafi and the West is dizzying, to say the least. One moment he's a villain, the next a friend. Then, at the start of 2011, the world turns on its axis one more time. This is one of Gaddafi's last televised speeches. It's February 2011, and the Arab Spring, sparked by anger over decades of corruption, political oppression, and dictatorship, is sweeping through North Africa. The cameras panning across a war-torn building and one of Gaddafi's infamous statues of a fist crushing a US fighter jet to prove he's still in Libya, despite rumors of his escape to Venezuela. Gaddafi's grip on the country is slipping, and now protests against him are erupting across Libya. He's clearly emotional, angry, and quite obviously, delusional. Any act of insurrection, he says, will be punishable by execution. Then he delivers his final threat. We and millions from the Sahara will cleanse Libya inch by inch, house by house, home by home, alleyway by alleyway, person by person, until the country is cleansed of dirt and scum. This is Gaddafi still playing the role of Libya's absolute ruler, the role he's been playing for more than 40 years. But the Libya he thinks he commands no longer exists. And his words, alleyway by alleyway, or Zenga Zenga in Arabic, take on a life of their own. Across eastern Libya, people shout it jokingly. They even turn it into a song. We can't play it due to copyright, but it's on YouTube and definitely worth a watch. Suddenly Britain, France, and America have a problem. Just months ago, Gaddafi was their ally. Both American and British oil companies have valuable oil contracts with Libya, and British arms manufacturers supply the regime. And now, as protests sweep the Arab world, they look ineffective at best and complicit at worst. And while the rebellion against Gaddafi starts out strong, the rebels quickly find themselves outmatched and outgunned. In Misrata, artillery shells from Gaddafi's cannons fall every 6 minutes. Doctors work by candlelight in hospitals filled with the screams of the dying. Civilians cower in basements as Gaddafi's tanks roll through their neighbourhoods. The rebels, who've never known protest, let alone war, have no option but to retreat. In the United Nations, debates rage over how to respond. China, Germany, India and Russia express concerns about sovereignty and the risks of foreign meddling. On the other hand, the US, backed by France, the UK and a coalition of Western and Arab nations, argue that intervention is necessary to prevent a humanitarian disaster and protect Libyan civilians. It's a mishmash of alliances and competing interests. It's confusing and a political nightmare, and as a result, the United Nations are slow to react. But, around the middle of March, the United Nations finally authorise international intervention, and, within days, NATO airstrikes hit Gaddafi's forces, targeting airfields, armoured columns and supply lines. Gaddafi's advantage begins to unravel. Behind the scenes, British MI6 agents and French intelligence operatives work directly with the rebels and provide critical intelligence on Gaddafi's troop movements. NATO's overwhelming air power also helps to dismantle Gaddafi's forces, and by August, the rebels finally seize Tripoli. Gaddafi, who's been hiding in Tripoli, is forced to flee to Sirte, where he moves from villa to villa with the last of his fighters and advisers still loyal to him. Reports suggest that he's becoming increasingly detached from reality, convinced that the Libyan people still love him. But by October, the end is near. Sirte, now reduced to rubble by NATO airstrikes and weeks of fierce fighting, offers few places to hide. So, his son Mutasim organises a heavily armoured convoy of dozens of vehicles carrying around 200 armed fighters. Their plan is to reach the desert, where Gaddafi wants to make his last stand. But, almost as soon as they hit the road, a NATO missile hits the front of the convoy, just ahead of Gaddafi's four-wheel drive. Gaddafi, along with Mutasim, a small group of bodyguards, and his defence minister, abandons the convoy and flees on foot. As they fight off the encroaching rebels, they take shelter in a drainage pipe near the road. They're now completely surrounded. Suddenly, a large bang echoes from within the pipe. A grenade has exploded and bits of dust and cement shoot out of the opening. Wounded and confused, Gaddafi emerges from the pipe. The rebels run at him, guns firing, as the now former dictator asks his captors, "What's wrong with you? What's happening?" They're his final recorded words. In Washington, President Obama is among the first to celebrate the fall of the regime, and he's quick to declare it a warning to other authoritarian leaders. But the US doesn't actually have any real idea of what to do with Libya in the aftermath. Years later, he will candidly admit that the lack of planning for post-Gaddafi Libya was the worst mistake of his presidency. In London, David Cameron calls Gaddafi's death Libya's first step toward democracy. But his words fall flat against Britain's very recent history with the regime and a relationship built on oil contracts and pragmatic diplomacy. Meanwhile, in Paris, Nicolas Sarkozy's celebrations faces its own contradictions as reports begin to surface about Gaddafi's alleged financing of his 2007 presidential campaign. And in Libya, the power vacuum left by Gaddafi is felt immediately. The country splinters into warring factions. Militias armed with weapons that flooded the country during the uprising battle for control. And the very Western powers that were so decisive in their intervention suddenly appear less certain about reconstruction. Within 6 to 12 months after Gaddafi's death, their focus shifts elsewhere, leaving Libya to grapple with its newfound freedom on its own.